WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time. D-ball!
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross.
Everybody's talking, no one says a word. Everybody's making love, no one really cares. There's
Natchez. After John Lennon moved to New York in the early 70s, his anti-war music and his affiliation with anti-war leaders made him a threat to the Nixon administration. The FBI had Lennon under surveillance, and the INS tried to deport him. The new documentary, The U.S. vs. John Lennon, tells the story of the government's attempts to silence him. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with historian John Wiener. He sued the FBI to get access to Lennon's FBI files and is the author of the book Gimme Some Truth. He also was a consultant on the new documentary. Also, we preview the new TV season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Nobody told me there'd be days like these. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Anti-war music like Give Peace a Chance didn't exactly endear John Lennon to the Nixon administration. In 1971, shortly after Lennon had come to New York on a visa and hooked up with radical anti-war activists, the FBI put Lennon under surveillance and the Immigration and Naturalization Service tried to deport him. The new documentary, The U.S. vs. John Lennon, is about the government's attempts to silence John Lennon. Here's a clip from the film. First, we'll hear British music journalist Chris Charlesworth, and then archival footage of Lennon himself.
John was no dummy. He knew that people would regard him as being a nutcase. Right? He didn't care. He thought that whatever people thought about him was unimportant compared to the cause he was promoting.
If I'm going to get on the front page, I might as well get on the front page with the word peace.
But you've made yourself ridiculous.
To some people, I don't care.
If it you're too good for
if
what
it
you're
saves
doing.
Lives...
You don't think you... Oh, my dear boy, you're living in another netherland.
Well, you were saying that in America they're so serious about the protest movement.
Yes, they are.
But they were so flippant that they were singing a happy-go-lucky song, which happens to be one I wrote, and I'm glad they sang it. And when I get there, I'll sing it with them.
Our guest, John Wiener, is a historian who was a consultant on the film and who investigated what the FBI and the INS did to Lennon between 1971 and 1972. After Lennon's death, Wiener requested Lennon's FBI files under the Freedom of Information Act. But the FBI refused to release many of the documents, saying their release would endanger national security. So with the help of the ACLU, Wiener sued the FBI in 1983. 14 years later, after the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, the FBI agreed to settle and released all but 10 of the documents. Those 10 documents still haven't been released. Wiener's book about the documents, named after a Lennon song, is called Gimme Some Truth. Wiener is a history professor at the University of California, Irvine. He spoke with Terry Gross in 2000. His book opens with a 1972 memo from Senator Strom Thurmond to Nixon's assistant, William Timmons.
Strom Thurmond, at the time, was chair of the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, which apparently was working closely with the FBI and monitoring anti-war protests in the United States. The Strom Thurmond memo outlined a plan Lennon had been developing with some friends of his in the anti-war movement for a national concert tour that Lennon would headline that would coincide with the upcoming 1972 election season. Strom Thurmond pointed out that this was not going to be the usual rock concert tour. It's kind of strange to get this from Strom Thurmond, since you don't usually think of him as an expert on rock venues. But he, or his staff anyway, appreciated what was interesting here, that this wasn't just going to be the first live tour by one of the Beatles since the lads waved farewell in Candlestick Park 5 years earlier. Lennon hoped to combine rock music with radical politics and organize young people to vote in the 1972 election. Thurmond thought that the Nixon White House should know about these plans because they seemed to have political significance for Nixon's reelection.
Read the last paragraph for us of that letter.
Okay, the Strom Thurmond memo concludes, "The source felt that if Lennon's visa is terminated, it would be a strategic countermeasure. The source also noted the caution which must be taken with regard to the possible alienation of the so-called 18-year-old vote if Lennon is expelled from the country."
How do you interpret that last paragraph about the strategic countermeasure?
Well, little historical background here. The 72 election was going to be the first in which 18-year-olds had the right to vote. Before that, you had to be 21. Everybody knew that young people were the strongest anti-war constituency, but also all real politicos know that then, and as well as today, young people are the least likely to vote. So the question was, for Lennon, how could he use his power as a celebrity to get young people into the political process? And also, this is a time when kids are very alienated from, you know, mainstream politics. So to get Lenin out of the country. The strategic countermeasure is to deport Lenin so he won't be able to take this this tour that would register young voters. At the same time, they're worried that, you know, young voters will vote against Nixon for kicking out, you know, the clever beetle.
How much were you able to find out about the extent to which the Nixon White House and Nixon himself was involved in this plan to deport Lenin so that he couldn't mobilize youth to vote against Nixon?
Well, the FBI files that have been released to me, there's nothing directly from or to Richard Nixon himself. However, there is one memo from J. Edgar Hoover to Robert Haldeman, who was the assistant to the president, the closest person to Nixon in the White House. That memo reports on the FBI's progress in building a deportation case against Lenin. My assumption is that there's no reason to tell this to Haldeman unless Nixon is interested.
Now, how accurate was the FBI's information that John Lennon did want to help organize these political concerts that would be for peace and against Nixon?
There's no question that Lennon was talking about this with his friends being Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, Bobby Seale. And they tried doing one of these. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, in December 1971, John and Yoko headlined a political rock concert, the Free John Sinclair Concert. Every once in a while, I run into somebody who was there. 15,000 people spent 6 hours in Chrysler Arena. They listened not only to John and Yoko, but Stevie Wonder came, Commander Cody came, the MC5 came. William Kunstler gave a speech, Jerry Rubin gave a speech, Bobby Seale gave a speech. And a lot of it was about, you know, mobilizing young people to oppose Nixon. So they were very excited. John and Yoko were very excited about the tremendous turnout they had for this concert and how successful it was. So they were interested in the idea. They never got to the stage of setting up the national concert tour because the deportation order came down just 2 months later.
Now, was the deportation order issued because of this campaign to get rid of Lenin before he could organize youth to vote?
Well, it certainly seems that way. That's what Lenin always said, and that's what his fans all thought. Of course, the Nixon administration immigration service had a different explanation. They said that Lenin never should have been admitted to the United States in the first place because the then existing immigration law prohibited admission of anyone who had been convicted of any drug offense, no matter how minor, no matter what the circumstances. And Lenin, in fact, had pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge of cannabis possession in London in 1969 when he was busted by the infamous detective Sergeant Norman Pilcher, a name that will live in infamy among all Beatle fans. Lenin pled guilty, even though he claimed the drugs were planted on him. And indeed, a couple of years later, Sergeant Pilcher was found guilty of planting drugs on another celebrity, and he himself went to jail. But the Nixon administration's view was that they were simply enforcing the immigration law, and Lenin's legal case was actually a pretty weak one at that point.
How far did the INS get in deporting Lenin?
Well, for much of 1972 and 73, Lenin was under an order to leave the country within 60 days. He had very talented legal help, and they kept getting these deadlines extended. There was a lot of people mobilized to support him, but it wasn't until after Watergate, after Nixon left office, that the Gerald Ford administration Immigration Service finally agreed to grant Lenin his green card on a very narrow legal ground. So for 2 years, he was under a 60-day order to leave the country almost continuously.
Now, let's talk more about the FBI documents that you were finally able to get through, the Freedom of Information Act. You say that the FBI documents make the FBI look more like the Keystone Cops than the Gestapo. Give us an example of one of the documents that you think makes them look like Keystone Cops.
Well, there's one where J. Edgar Hoover sends out instructions to locate Lenin as quickly as possible. They say his last known address is St. Regis Hotel, 150 Bank Street, New York City. Now, every cop and cab driver in New York knows that the St. Regis Hotel, you know, is on Central Park. It's not, and that Bank Street is in the West Village. So this couldn't be right. In fact, Lennon at the time was living on Bank Street, but he was living at 105 Bank Street, not 150 Bank Street. So here's like this all points bulletin, you know, find Lennon. They're just confused. I mean, it could have happened to any of us, I guess. The other really strange one is that there's a kind of a wanted poster for Lennon. The FBI proposed that Lennon should be arrested, if at all possible, on possession of narcotics charges. I'm quoting now from one of the documents, which would make him more immediately deportable. And these instructions to local police officials include a kind of a wanted poster, a picture of Lennon, you know, height, weight, eye color, and so on. You'd think that they wouldn't really need this. Lennon was certainly one of the most recognizable faces in the world in 1972. They have a picture there anyway, but the strangest thing is the picture isn't of John Lennon. It's of another guy. A guy, I mean, I know who it is. It's a guy named David Peel, who was an East Village folk singer, street singer, busker type, who looked a little like Lennon. I mean, he wore the wire-rimmed glasses and had Lennon's style of long hair. Of course, lots of other people did in 1972. David Peel had recorded on Apple Records. Maybe that's how they got confused. So the FBI, you know, was lamentably out of touch with the mainstream, not just of, you know, the radical counterculture of New York City, but you would think John Lennon is kind of pretty much the mainstream in 1972.
Historian John Wiener speaking with Terry Gross about the John Lennon FBI files. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with historian John Wiener. He sued the FBI over access to John Lennon's FBI files and is the author of the book, Gimme Some Truth.
Now, you also say that you're surprised at how trivial some of the documents that the FBI withheld from you turned out to be. The FBI also seemed to just collect some interesting left-wing gossip. I'd like you to read an excerpt of a document that's a good example of that. This is on page 253. This is really a memo about Jerry Rubin and how a lot of the people he was working with thought that his ego had just gotten too big and they really needed to put him in his place.
We listed our bitches to him, his superstar ego, which enables him to appear to lead while he does none of the work yet gets the credit. Number two, financial deals that have netted him money in the past that he made in the name of Yippie, but then used for himself. Three, his B.O. and other bad habits. Four, his feud with Tom and other Zip people.
That's Tom Hayden, right?
You know,
Maybe not.
This is, the Zippies were right. A split from the Yippies. So I think this was not Tom
Another
Hayden's
Tom.
World.
Okay.
No, Tom was a sober type. He was not a Zippy. Shall I continue?
Please.
He said that he would do anything and we should just tell him what we wanted. They told him they wanted money, and they told him that they wanted him to get signatures for the Armstrong petition. They also told him that we would stop bad rapping him, I think it's supposed to be, in accordance with how well he performs his assignments. We will make no interferences in his affairs, political or otherwise, as long as he didn't claim leadership in Zip or Yip. He will have no decision-making powers. If he or Abby Hoffman, want responsibilities in the new party, they will have to earn them like everyone else. The fact that they are superstars and can get coverage of events does not impress us at all. They are a liability within the movement. They have turned too many people off.
Now there's an example of the FBI doing some interesting historical work for us.
Yes, this is certainly... You know, this is the kind of record keeping that doesn't exist anywhere else, and it's the reason that historians practice the Freedom of Information Act. You know, I doubt that there were minutes taken at this meeting, which someone filed and are now located in an archive. The FBI is the only institution that had the energy and the resources, you know, excessive as they were, to keep these kind of documents. On the other hand, my attorneys in the ACLU cited this passage in arguing that the FBI lacked a legitimate law enforcement purpose in gathering this information, that the whole thing was illegitimate and they shouldn't have been doing it in the first place.
Now, you actually got to meet the person who was the source for that document. You met the informant, and the informant ended up helping you in your fight to get the FBI files.
Well, I talked to her on the phone. This was one of the more unexpected developments. 10 years or so into this case, I got a phone call one day from a woman named Julie Maynard in Madison, Wisconsin, who said that she was the full-time paid confidential informant who had provided the FBI with information about Lennon, and she had had a change of heart. She had split with the FBI, and she wanted to join our side. This is something that hardly has ever happened in history. So we were, you know, pretty excited about it, but also we were a little skeptical because, you know, you can never be sure if the information that informants provide is completely true or accurate. Their whole occupation depends on convincing their employers that they are unique sources of extremely valuable information, even if it isn't very unique or very valuable. Julie signed an affidavit saying she wanted the FBI to turn over all of her materials that she provided on Lennon to us. This was quite important because the FBI was maintaining at the time that they were obligated to withhold confidential informant reports from us to protect the identity of the sources. Here, for the first time, I believe, in FOIA litigation, one of the sources said they didn't want their identity protected. Initially, the FBI rejected Julie Maynard's affidavit, which they called irrelevant. It seemed to me it was extremely relevant. But eventually, a few years later, they did release all of her confidential informant reports, and we found out that indeed she was the author of this one. She was the one who was at this meeting. After the case was finally settled in 1997, I called up Julie to tell her, you know, what had happened, that we'd gotten her documents at last. I learned that she had died just a few months before.
Well, let's get to the sentence that you describe as the most remarkable sentence in all of the confidential information that you finally got from the FBI. What is the sentence?
This is in the same document that Julie Maynard provided, confidential informant report on a meeting planning demonstrations at the Republican National Convention in 1972. The FBI claimed that they had a legitimate law enforcement purpose in investigating Lennon, namely that he planned to participate in violent disruptive demonstrations at this Republican National Convention, which would have been a violation of the Anti-Riot Act passed after the demonstrations at the 68th Democratic National Convention. Julie Maynard's report on this meeting concludes that Lennon said, quote, he will come to the conventions if they are peaceful, close quote. In other words, the FBI's own paid confidential informants were giving them information that contradicted what they claimed as the basis for their investigation of Lennon. We argued, therefore, they lacked a legitimate law enforcement purpose, that they knew they lacked a legitimate law enforcement purpose, and therefore they should release the files to us.
And was that a key point in getting the files released?
Well, you know, they never told us their reasoning about why they finally released them. They maintained throughout all the litigation that their fears were legitimate and the times are different now, and it's hard to appreciate today how tense the world was in 1972, and it's the FBI's job to protect the president, and they were doing their job. And now times are different, is their view.
Did you find anything in the FBI files that were released to you that indicated that the FBI went beyond surveillance, that they ever tried to set Lennon up?
Yeah, there's a couple of documents. Their concern was that Lenin would participate in some kind of concert, rally, anti-war demonstration outside the Republican National Convention. And there's a memo from J. Edgar Hoover to the head of the Miami FBI office that suggests that if Lenin could be arrested on possession of narcotics charges, he would become more immediately deportable. Now, this seems to me an effort to set Lenin up for a drug bust. The FBI doesn't enforce possession of narcotics charges. That's a state offense. This is not part of what the FBI is supposed to be doing. I then filed a Freedom of Information request with the Miami FBI office, asking for their files on Lenin to see what their response to this was. They replied to me that their John Lenin file had been destroyed as a part of a routine file destruction procedure.
Hmm.
Now, I have to note that Lenin files were collected in five other cities, and none of those places destroyed their Lenin files. So we wonder what was in the Miami Lenin file that was destroyed.
Historian John Wiener speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. He sued the FBI over access to John Lennon's FBI files. We'll hear more of their interview in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Karma's gonna get you. Gonna look you right in the face.
Better get yourself together, darling.
Join the human race.
Coming up, more on the John Lenin FBI files. We continue our conversation with John Wiener, author of Gimme Some Truth. He also was a consultant on the new documentary, The U.S. versus John Lenin. And we take a look at the new TV season. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, and back with historian John Wiener. The new documentary, The U.S. versus John Lenin, tells the story of the government's attempts to silence Lenin. Wiener sued the FBI in 1983 to get Lenin's files released under the Freedom of Information Act. 14 years later, after the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, the FBI settled and released all but 10 documents. The FBI had Lenin under surveillance from 1971 to 1972. Terry spoke with Wiener in 2000 about the John Lenin FBI files.
Now, you have the FBI document that explains why the FBI stopped its surveillance of Lenin. Would you summarize and read an excerpt of that document for us?
This is dated August 30th, 1972. This is like 2 months before the presidential election. This is a memo to the acting director. Now, that's L. Patrick Gray. J. Edgar Hoover had died in May, from the special agent in charge of the New York FBI office. It says, "For the past several months, there has been no information received to indicate that the subject is active in the new left." Then it indicates what the sources are. "All advised that during the month of July 1972, that the subject has fallen out of favor of activists Jerry Rubin, Stuart Albert, and Rennie Davis due to subject's lack of interest in committing himself to involvement in anti-war and new left activities. In view of this information, the New York Division is placing this case in a pending inactive status."
Now, is that true of the whole FBI or just the New York Division?
Well, New York was the office of origin, the OO, as it's called in the files. They're the ones who are responsible for conducting the investigation. I mean, what this really is saying here is that the Immigration Service and the FBI have succeeded in pressuring Lenin to cancel his plans for this national concert tour and to withdraw from anti-war activity. His lawyers told him that his case for fighting deportation was a pretty weak one. In fact, they'd never seen anyone win a case under these terms. And therefore, the legal advice was don't do anything more that would further provoke the Nixon administration. He really wanted to stay in the United States. Yoko was involved at that point in a custody dispute over her daughter from a previous marriage, her daughter Kyoko. So, John, if he had been deported, Yoko would have stayed behind. He didn't want to be separated from Yoko. So he canceled the plans for the concert tour. He dropped out of movement activity, and the FBI is reporting that they've accomplished their job.
So in that sense, the FBI did succeed in neutralizing, as they like to put it, in neutralizing John Lennon.
Yeah, neutralizing is one of the scary words which appear in the file. Some people think this refers, you know, to assassination plans or something like that. I don't think that's the case. Neutralizing means silencing him, getting him out of the picture through this deportation threat. And there's no question that Lenin was silenced as a spokesman of the anti-war movement.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Wiener. He's a historian and author of the new book, Give Me Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files. And he tried to get those files for about 14 years in a series of lawsuits. Why did you initially want to get the John Lennon FBI files?
Well, after Lennon was killed, December 1980, I'm a historian. I teach history at the University of California, Irvine. I'm also a journalist. And I wanted to, you know, I was a Lennon fan, and I wanted to write something or do something. And actually started as a radio program on KPFK, Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. I was going to do their tribute to John Lennon that was going to focus on his peace movement activities. And at that time, the Martin Luther King FBI file had just come to light and been published. And historians everywhere were amazed to discover how complete FBI records were on Martin Luther King, much more detailed than anything in King's own archives. And I just wondered whether there might be something like that for John Lennon, since I knew that Nixon had tried to deport him in 1972. So I filed a Freedom of Information request, just, you know, the way historians do who have biographical projects, early in 1981. They do what they always do. They send you some pages and they black out a lot of other pages. I was lucky enough to get the help of the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California in filing a lawsuit in 1983. And then we spent the next 15 years in court.
Now, you got some documents that had a lot blacked out in them initially, and then when you won your case, a lot of those blacked out parts were actually printed. What were some of the things that were blacked out the first time around that you got to read later on?
Well, about two-thirds of all, there's about 400 pages in all the different parts of the Lennon FBI file. Initially, in 1981, about two-thirds of those were blacked out, mostly under the claim that releasing them would endanger the national security of the United States. You know, now the book contains almost clean versions of almost all of those pages. Some of the, you know, what we discovered was the contents of J. Edgar Hoover's letter to Haldeman showing the direct White House involvement. We found the proposals to set Lennon up for a drug bust, which seemed to clear abuse of the FBI's authority. We found all these trivial documents which suggested that the FBI didn't have any legitimate law enforcement purpose in investigating Lennon. Basically, we found a lot of evidence that this was not a criminal investigation, which, of course, is what the FBI is supposed to be doing. This was political surveillance and political harassment of a critic of the president. That's what Lennon had said back in 1972 when he was in the immigration hearings. But, you know, it's nice to see the historical documents that confirm what you argued and suspected in the past.
Now, your lawsuit took about 14 years. You sued, appealed, and so on. It finally went to the Supreme Court. How did it end up going that high?
Well, we lost in U.S. District Court in Los Angeles. Then we appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and there we got a strong and unanimous ruling from a three-judge panel that the FBI's procedure for describing the contents of the files they were withholding was unacceptable and that they had to completely revise their procedures for processing freedom of information withholding. They claimed this imposed what they called an intolerable burden on them, and the FBI appealed to the Supreme Court to free them from this intolerable burden. The Lennon file is only 400 pages, but there are other files that are, you know, 40,000 pages or 400,000 pages. The Supreme Court, to our amazement and delight, agreed with the ACLU position that this was not an intolerable burden, that it was required by the Freedom of Information Act. And even the Reagan appointees, you know, Rehnquist and Scalia, joined in supporting the ACLU position and opposing the FBI's position. So that then it was sent back to district court in L.A., and the judge was ordered to start over at the beginning.
Now, one of the things very interesting about the Supreme Court decision is that this is where Kenneth Starr enters the John Lennon story, the Kenneth Starr who was the independent counsel.
Yes, I noticed that, too. The Justice Department briefed to the Supreme Court explaining why they shouldn't have to redo their entire procedures because of the findings in the John Lennon's FBI file case are submitted by Kenneth Starr, Solicitor General. Of course, I had no idea who Kenneth Starr, Solicitor General, was when all this was happening in 1990. In retrospect, it's one of those strange historical facts.
So Kenneth Starr was representing the FBI.
Yeah, well, it turns out, I mean, the lawyers say, well, Kenneth Starr files all the government briefs with the Supreme Court. That's the job of the Solicitor General, is to represent the FBI before the Supreme Court. Nothing unusual about that.
Historian John Wiener speaking with Terry Gross about the John Lennon FBI files. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Cookie.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with historian John Wiener. He sued the FBI over access to John Lennon's FBI files and is the author of the book, Gimme Some Truth.
How much do you think John Lennon knew about the FBI's surveillance of him?
Well, he understood that this whole deportation thing was politically motivated. He complained publicly on TV shows, on the Mike Douglas show, on the Dick Cavett show, you know, these criminal enterprises, that too many people were coming to fix his phones down on Bank Street in the West Village, and that there were strange men outside in suits who followed him around. He eventually sued the FBI, claiming he had been the target of illegal wiretapping. Part of his FBI file is the FBI's own response to that charge. They replied that they could find no evidence of authorized wiretapping in their files. Now, this seems to me like a typical Nixon-era non-denial denial. They said they could find no evidence, but maybe they didn't look very hard. They said they could find no evidence of authorized wiretapping, but it could have been unauthorized. It's also possible that the wiretapping was not done by the FBI, but was done by the New York police or some other agency. So Lennon sometimes thought he was just being paranoid. He would say, you know, he wasn't important enough to be the target of this kind of surveillance. At other times, he loudly proclaimed that he was the target of government persecution. It turns out it's the second that was correct, but he never was sure in his own time that it was the FBI that was after him.
Do you have evidence that his phone really was tapped?
There are no wiretapping logs in the Lennon FBI file of the kind that there are, say, in the Martin Luther King file. So. Mm-hmm. This remains an open question. I mean, he lived next door to John Cage on Bank Street, and whenever he needed to make a, it's the '60s. It's the West Village in the '60s. Whenever he needed to make a secure conversation, they would go next door and use John Cage's phone in the belief that the FBI didn't know who John Cage was. They're probably right about that.
Right. The FBI wasn't interested in chance music, huh?
Probably not.
The fact that the FBI conducted surveillance against people who it considered, political dissidents is enough evidence that conspiracy theorists need to show that the FBI was involved in lots of other things, too, such as the assassination of John Lennon. Have you found any evidence at all that would support any conspiracy views about the assassination of John Lennon?
None at all. All the FBI files that have been released to me date from 1971 and 72. They're all about Lennon's political activism in opposing Nixon's reelection. Once Nixon is reelected in November 72, the FBI closes their file on Lennon. They had accomplished their goal. When Lennon was killed, 1980, that's 8 years later, it's a completely different political world. Jimmy Carter is president. Lennon had been a house husband for 5 years. I just don't see any motive for any conspiracy in killing Lennon at that time. And, the attempt to kill George Harrison is an excellent example of how celebrities become the target of murderous fantasies of demented fans. And I'm pretty sure that that's what happened.
You say in your book that one of the things you really find fascinating about these FBI files is that they document an era when rock music seemed to have real political force. Say some more about that.
Well, it's a little hard to believe that a president would fear the power of a rock star. It's still hard to figure out whether the effort to deport Lennon was complete paranoia on Nixon's part. After all, Nixon did win the 1972 election by an overwhelming landslide. His opponent, George McGovern, carried, two or three states, something like that. So maybe the whole thing was just paranoia on the part of Nixon matched by paranoia on the part of Lennon and his friends. On the other hand, all of this was put in motion long before that presidential election, in the winter beforehand. And at that point, I don't think it was clear to anybody that Nixon was going to win in a landslide. Nixon was concerned about this youth vote and how that might affect the elections. Wasn't clear that McGovern was going to be the candidate. There's a lot of reasons not to like Richard Nixon. I never liked him very much myself. But, he was one of the most successful political candidates in recent history. So I'm kind of willing to accept Nixon's judgment that Lennon's political plans for 1972 were significant, were interesting, and, did merit some kind of presidential response.
And that's something that you find interesting about the times and something that you admire Lennon for.
Yeah, I mean, Lennon really took risks here of a kind that you hardly see anybody ever taking. How many people in the entertainment world have faced deportation because of their political actions? I mean, Charlie Chaplin was sort of run out of the United States. Paul Robeson left, it was sort of the opposite, where he was denied the right to travel, and then he left the, you know, anyway. Bertolt Brecht fled after being quizzed by HUAC. This is a very small group of people. So I think it underscores the intensity of Lenin's commitment. I mean, I don't think he knew the risks he was taking, but that's sort of what he was like. He was a risk taker. He wanted to stand up for what he believed in. He wasn't going to play it safe. It wasn't a safe age. So I think that's admirable.
Has reading all the files about John Lennon, the FBI files, changed your impressions of Lennon? I mean, there are insights from from these informant documents. Has it added to your knowledge of John Lennon the man, added to your knowledge of his character or how he behaved in the world?
Well, you know, this is a period which people don't pay very much attention to anymore when they're remembering Lennon. You know, it was really less than 12 months. But reading these files, you get a sense of just what an intense and devastating period this was for Lennon. That he starts out full of enthusiasm, high hopes, going to do this concert tour. He hadn't performed live for 5 years. You know, excited to be in New York, the center of the universe. Within a couple of months, he is feeling the heavy hand of the government of the most powerful country in the world, which, you know, wants to get rid of him, wants to kick him out. And it really, I think it ruined his life for the next few years. And it's easier to see, you know, what happened to him. And the next year, his music kind of falls apart. His couple of albums that he makes here are, pretty much the worst of his career. He breaks up with Yoko, moves out to L.A. on the so-called lost weekend, living the life of a kind of over-the-hill rock star. I think all of this is, I don't know how much he understood at the time, but this is sort of the time when he's lost his optimism, he's lost his hope, he's been punished for not doing very much. And he paid a heavy price, both as a creative person and in his own life.
Well, John Wiener, I thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Historian John Wiener, speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. He sued the FBI over access to John Lennon's FBI files and is the author of the book Gimme Some Truth. The new documentary, The U.S. Versus John Lennon, about the government's attempts to silence Lennon, will be released in New York and L.A. today and nationwide later this month.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so f***ing crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be.
Coming up, what to watch and what not to on TV this fall. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
And now I'd like to shift gears and shift duties to TV critic. And boys and girls, I'd like to start with a little story. Once upon a time, back in the 1960s, there were three commercial broadcast networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, and that was it. No satellite, no cable, no internet. The broadcast networks were unbelievably dominant then. They supplied most of the TV to America, just like Detroit supplied most of the cars. The car manufacturers rolled out their new models in September and wanted as many people as possible to watch their advertisements. So somewhere along the line, the assembly line that is, the networks and the car companies came up with the idea of the fall TV season. The networks could roll out their new models, too, all in the same week, and that would attract lots of viewers to the truly important stuff, the ads for the new cars. Well, kiddies, it's a very different world today, but some old traditions have remained. New car models still come out in the fall, and even though the Fox network jumped the gun this year by previewing its new shows the past few weeks, there's still an official fall TV season. It starts Monday. Next week alone, 8 new series premiere on network TV. The big trend this fall is that all the networks are betting more than ever on serialized dramas. With the success of the Fox series 24 and the ABC series Lost and Desperate Housewives, the networks see these involved season-long story arcs as one possible way to attract and hook an audience. It doesn't matter that last year most of those attempts failed. Loyal viewers of such shows as Invasion, Threshold, Surface, and Reunion were abandoned in mid-story with no sense of closure. But since another new serialized drama, Prison Break, worked for Fox, all the networks are willing to try again. There are so many new ones this season, though, that oversaturation is inevitable. There are only so many books people can keep on their nightstand at one time, and serialized TV dramas require the same type of focus and commitment. If you're already looking forward to new chapters of Lost and Grey's Anatomy, or of 24 and Veronica Mars, how many new weekly dramas can you make room for? Well, from the new fall season, I'd suggest making room for a few. Especially ABC's The Nine, which is about 9 people caught up, in one way or another, in a midday bank robbery. The show premieres October 4th, right after the season premiere of Lost. And it's the same kind of character-driven mystery series, with lots of flashbacks and missing pieces to its puzzle. In fact, in The Nine, we don't initially see the robbery, or what happens during it. That'll come later, bit by bit. In the pilot, we see only the aftermath, and scenes of the moments leading up to the robbery. Such as this scene, in which Timothy Daly plays Nick, a cop being chewed out by his boss.
You haven't been going to your GA meetings.
The department mandated 6. I did my 6.
So you're cured.
Come on, Pete. This group thing is not for me. But haven't laid a bet in 3 months. Haven't even bought a lotto ticket.
All I'm saying is, with your history, you don't have a lot of...
Leave my father out of this.
This has nothing to do with your father. I'm just looking out for you, Nick.
Well, I'm the guy with the most collars last year. If you're really looking out for me, shouldn't we be talking about the promotion I was promised?
We were ready to give you that promotion until you blew it, your little gambling mishap. I'm not the one who keeps shooting you in the foot here, Nick. You do a pretty good job of that yourself.
Okay, then. I'm going to go deposit my paycheck in my savings account.
Other cast members of The Nine include Kim Raver from 24, John Billingsley from Prison Break, and Scott Wolf from Party of Five, all serialized dramas. The Nine is a very crisp pilot and one of the 3 new shows I recommend most enthusiastically this year. The other two, as I noted months ago when the fall pilots were screened for critics, are both from NBC, and both are behind-the-scenes looks at network TV sketch comedy shows. The one from Aaron Sorkin, his first series since The West Wing, is called Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, and premieres Monday. It stars Bradley Whitford, Matthew Perry, and Amanda Peet, and features a can't-miss opening appearance by Judd Hirsch. The other TV show about a TV show is called 30 Rock and comes from Tina Fey of Saturday Night Live. She stars in it, too, along with Alec Baldwin and SNL veteran Tracy Morgan. The show's being reworked, with Jane Krakowski from Ally McBeal added to the cast. But the parts being worked on are the parts that needed work, and the rest is hilarious, and I adore Jane Krakowski. So watch for 30 Rock, too, but be patient because it doesn't show up until October 11th. Other new shows worth sampling this season include Kidnapped, an NBC drama that starts Wednesday and plans to take the whole season to explore one crime, and ABC's Ugly Betty, a comedy that's an American take on a successful telenovela. It starts September 28th. And ABC's The Knights of Prosperity, a serialized comedy series about a group of first-time inept criminals. It starts October 17th and used to be known by a much better title, Let's Rob Mick Jagger. And yes, Mick Jagger appears in it, at least in the pilot. That's a pretty good start. Add the quality returning shows and some of the other new ones that have promise, and you've got a much better than average fall TV season. And even if nothing here strikes your fancy, there's always mid-season. One of the replacements due to arrive in January is The Black Donnellys, written by Paul Haggis of Crash. The last TV projects created by Haggis were two of my all-time favorites, Due South and Easy Streets. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Hollywood Records, presenting Indigo Girls' new album, Despite Our Differences, available in stores September 19th. More information at indigogirls.com. And from Universal Pictures, presenting The Black Dahlia, from the director of Scarface and the author of L.A. Confidential, The Black Dahlia, now in theaters. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Christians United for Israel is a new group that sees the rebirth of Israel as a prelude to the second coming of Jesus Christ. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the group's founder, Pastor John Hagee, and from an Israeli and an American journalist who question if Hagee's end-of-days vision is in Israel's best interests. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.